Welcome, Eastern family and friends. We're coming to you live from our 6 satellite studios with our 58th broadcast. Once again, we're coming to you from Jacksonville, Florida, West Palm Beach, Florida, Delray Beach, Florida, The Villages, Florida, Grand Junction, Colorado, and Roaring Gap, North Carolina. Your hosts for tonight's broadcast are Bud Hescock, Neil Holland, Hector Santa Maria in Jacksonville, Florida, Bill Joseph in Grand Junction, Steve Thompson in Roaring Gap, let me say that again, North Carolina, Chuck Albright in The Villages, Ocala, Florida, and me, Margaret Bars, in Jacksonville. This week's show has the Eastern Radio crew flying a Boeing 727-200 aircraft to San Juan, Puerto Rico. The trip originates out of Atlanta, Georgia. We hope you'll enjoy your trip, as will the crew, during their layover. Now, last week's show was part one of this two-part radio show. The crew has arrived in San Juan, checked into their layover hotel, the Caribbean Hilton, and after the suggestion of Second Officer Neil, boarded the cruise ship Eastern Sunrise of the Caribbean for a three-hour guided tour. They've enjoyed their tour and the hospitality of the ship's captain, Howard Mucci, and they're now planning to leave the ship before its departure and cruise through the Caribbean. Our EL radio show tries to include Eastern aircraft and true stories for these Eastern radio broadcasts. So, just what is Eastern Radio Talk? Well, it's Eastern company news, employee news and interviews, aviation drama and fun skits, Eastern history, Eastern music, Eastern organizations and chapter news, an online weekly newsletter, and much, much more. Our website even has a page for those wanting to post their business cards. This is all for and about Eastern people and Eastern friends. And if you've listened to our past shows, you know that we can be reached online during our live broadcast. Our numbers are, once again, 213-816-1611 or toll-free at 877-572-1861. But let me repeat those numbers for you. Area code 213-816-1611 or toll free at area code 775-721-861. Now remember, when you're calling the show, it's very important. Make sure you press the number one button on your phone if you wish to connect live with our show.
Over the past year, we have delivered and archived over 57 hours of live Eastern radio talk, which we thought would be of interest and entertainment to our Eastern family and friends. We have listed the description of our favorite broadcast by episode numbers and placed them on the website for your quick review as to those you might want to play. Go to the radio episode page anytime, and you'll see it at the top of our website. Just click on the episode that you wish to listen to and enjoy the radio show. Now, Jerry Frost has burned, Captain Frost in Atlanta, has burned a DVD containing all 49 of the first episodes 1 through 49, and they are available to our members. Just let us know, and we'll send one out to you.
We left our Eastern Radio flight crew on board the Eastern Sunrise of the Caribbean in last week's episode, when the blast from the ship's horns advised all guests that it was now time for them to leave the ship just prior to departure. Wait, there's only 6 of them. It seems Bud is not among the crew members that came aboard earlier in the evening.
Hey, you all, has anyone seen Bud since out on the dance floor?
You know, he took a right fancy to that funny talking Victoria, the travel agent. Maybe she was going to give him a private tour of the ship or something. Anywho, he knows the rules. He's a big boy, and I ain't going to walk through 10 decks of cruise ship to find him. He heard the horns, or he fell overboard, one or the t'other.
I'm going to ask the boarding officer if he can make an announcement for him to come to the gangway immediately, as we need to get off the ship. I will also call Captain Mucci on the ship's phone to thank him for the wonderful evening and hope that if he has a chance to fly with Eastern, that to be sure to ask for the same courtesy he extended to us.
Well, he may have already left the ship. As you recall, he was having some stomach trouble from the Mexican food he had before coming on the trip. Probably got too much free food offered us by the captain, especially those yellow birds.
Every attempt to find Bud failed, and only a few minutes remained before the Eastern Sunrise of the Caribbean hauled its anchor for departure. The rest of the crew decided to find transportation back to their hotel, the Caribbean Hilton, hoping that Bud had found his way back and was sleeping it off.
Hey, guys, I'll give his room a call and see if he's returned to the hotel. Since we don't depart San Juan until tomorrow night, we should be able to locate him somewhere. If anyone finds him or locates him, just please give my room a call. It's room 905. Sleep well, you all.
Hey, Captain, this is Bud. I hope I didn't wake you.
No, Bud, I had to wake up for the phone that was just ringing in my ear, and it's only 3 o'clock in the morning. Why should I be asleep?
Sorry about that, Captain, but I thought you might want to know where I am. It's a long story, and I'd better wait until I see you before explaining.
All right, let's start out with, where are you?
Well, you're not going to believe it, but I'm docked here in St. Thomas. But don't worry, I'll be back before our departure, I hope.
Well, you know you could be arrested as a stowaway, Bud. What on earth happened to you?
Well, it's a long story, and I'll tell you when I get back to the hotel first thing this morning. I will identify myself to the captain and try to explain what happened. Second, I'll check Prinair's schedule for flights out of here back to San Juan. Attilly's flying boats also operate a frequent schedule throughout the islands, and I'll check with them, too.
Well, it's probably not a good idea to wake Captain Musi this time of the morning. You've already got one captain mad as hell. So just call me when you're back.
Okay.
First Officer Bud meets the captain on the bridge deck, where he explains as best he can why he is still on the ship. Captain Mucci, understanding the embarrassing situation, tells Bud that he wasn't the first to be in a similar situation. It happens. He tells Bud to go down to the boarding deck, and the boarding officer will have permission to let him debark without incidents. Meanwhile, the crew flying Eastern 58 back to Atlanta at 6 p.m. are having lunch in the hotel grill when First Officer Bud approaches.
Well, where did you guys go last night? I couldn't find any of you.
Now, Bud, you better have one heck of an explanation about your behavior last night. Did it have anything to do with Victoria's secret? I knew that girl was nothing but trouble.
Luann, nothing like you're thinking. Here's my story, believe it or not. We did leave the dance floor and go up to the sun deck, or shall I say star deck, and I got to feeling a little partially disorientated with all the food and yellow birds on top of that. I got very little sleep before coming on this trip. Well, Victoria suggested that I come to her cabin and go down and lay down for a few minutes and perhaps I'd feel better. I did, and the next thing I knew, the ship was in forward motion. I looked out the cabin window and saw nothing but water, moon, and stars. And it was 2 in the morning. I made a dash to leave the boat, but Victoria said you're going to have to swim a long way back to San Juan from St. Thomas. That's also about the time I discovered a severe pounding headache.
Lord have mercy, Bud. That's not the least bit creative. You got to do better than that. How about something like this? The ship was hijacked. You were the only one who could rescue the ship and the passengers, and you disarmed the hijackers, keeping them from carrying out their plan. I think that's more believable.
So someone once told me, for a very bad hangover, you take the juice of 2 quarts of whiskey. Maybe you need a glass of Alka-Seltzer. But then you might not be able to stand the noise. Here, bud, let's pull up a chair and order some food or coffee or whatever. It sure might help you.
Eastern Flight 58 is about to board passengers at Gate 9 for the trip back to Atlanta. The departure time is 6 p.m. and the crew has boarded and awaits the boarding of passengers.
Neil, did I ever tell you that I got a special instructions in the 1011 in Miami?
Taxiing? What on earth for? What type of instructions?
Well, there was a group that had to qualify on every piece of equipment that Eastern flew. I was one of 12 in the 1011 hangar that were senior mechanics, and we went through ground school, same as the pilots, to learn how to taxi all their airplanes. And I was in Miami at the time, and so consequently, one of my jobs was to taxi the airplanes from Miami, where you came in at the gate, over to the maintenance terminal. This came about because the pilots would have had to stay in the airplane at least an hour, probably 2 hours after their flight, on some of the maintenance hangars. So I think management and the pilot union decided it was better to have the mechanics go ahead and get checked out than to spend a lot of time, money, and effort in seeing that the pilots got back to the terminal and got back into their cars. So I was had a very good career along the way and running around doing all the things. One time I taxied 4 airplanes in 8 hours. Boy, that was a real long day.
Hey, Chuck, just out of curiosity, how long does it take for a person to be qualified taxiing, let's say, a L-1011? How long from start to when you sign them off and they're ready to do the taxiing for maintenance purposes?
Well, most of the time, at the terminal, when they come in, we obviously the crew is gone. And what we do is we go over the logbook with our lead man and we decide just exactly what has to be done to the airplane, whether it's going to be pulled inside the hangar or pulled out. Well, to do that, it takes approximately, I would say, a half hour to prepare the plane. And in Miami, I also did it in Atlanta. Atlanta's a little longer. It takes, if you get permission from the tower to go across the active runway, it only takes you maybe a half hour, 45 minutes to drive the plane over to the Miami 36th Street hangar area. But if you have a lot of traffic, like sometimes at night on the night shift in Miami and in Atlanta, where I went to Atlanta, I was stationed there, it would take you anywhere from an hour to 2 hours to taxi that plane all the way around and come around on the other side, and then park the plane.
Well, I'm sure glad that you're with us on this flight. Captain, I think I hear them calling from down below. I think they're ready to start when we are.
Okay, call Margaret up and see if she has everyone seated, and we get the papers from the agent. Looks like another on-time departure.
After a routine departure out of San Juan, Eastern Flight 58 is leveling off at a flight altitude of 370 when a knock at the cockpit door is heard.
Hey, Neil, look out that viewer and see who's knocking. The flight attendants should be using the radio or the call button dinner.
Yeah, that's not typical of Margaret. Wait a minute. Let me stand up here. Let me check this out. Hey, Captain, I see Margaret standing at the door. She must have her hands full with beverages and snacks for us.
The door is violently thrown open, and instead of Margaret, there stands a bearded man holding what appears to be a hand grenade. Margaret has been pushed aside up against the main cabin entrance door and lies helpless on the floor.
Everyone, stay where you are. No one will be harmed this flight if you do exactly as I demand. Do not attempt to make contact with air traffic controllers. If you do, we will all die. Sir, you're not part of the crew. Identify yourself.
No, I'm not. My name is Chuck. I'm an Eastern mechanic. I'm checking out this airplane. We've had experience in the past flights, unusual attitudes in flight.
What do you mean, unusual attitude?
Well, with the autopilot controlling the aircraft, we have sometimes experienced violent rolls and pitch changes. We have to quickly disarm the autopilot.
Sir, tell us, where is it you wish to go?
I demand you fly airplane immediately to Havana, Cuba. We're not be far away from Cuba now, yes?
Well, that's correct. We're about 400 miles from Cuba from this point.
Okay, I'll take your seat, Mr. Chuck. You go back and do not try anything stupid. Now, do not try to be heroes, or I will release my grip of the hand grenade, and you will never see this world again.
Captain, I'll go back, and don't know your name, sir.
My name? Alan Kagan. Now, tell me when we will arrive in Havana.
Well, I figured out the time of arrival, Captain, for Mr. Kagan, and make the necessary calls for Havana Center. I'd better notify the company also.
You will not call the company. Only communicate with Havana Center.
Bud dials in the frequency of Havana Center and discreetly puts the hijacking code into the transponder so that all air traffic controllers immediately see on their radar screens that Eastern Flight 58 is being hijacked.
Chuck, what's going on up in the front? He told me he was hijacking the plane to Cuba, and he would blow the airplane up with a hand grenade he was holding in his hand. He had my arm twisted as I knocked on the cockpit door. There was nothing I could do.
Settle down, Margaret. Are you hurt from the fall? We'll be all right if we do just as he says. Several other flights have been diverted to Havana, so ours should go along smoothly. I don't see anything we can do but to carry out his request. It's all up to the captain and the flight crew to make it as smooth as possible.
I guess I better say something to the passengers as to what's going on. I'm sure someone in the first class saw the scuffle we had when he forced me to open the cockpit door.
I would suggest you only tell those who ask you, and he may be listening in on the cabin announcements, you know.
Hey, what's going on up here? I heard someone in the back say there's somebody trying to get in the cockpit. Well, they better not, or I'll use my WMD heavy-duty flashlight on his head.
There's someone up front that's not supposed to be there, Luann. Did you say you had a heavy-duty flashlight? Maybe we could lay out a little plan. I told the hijacker I was in the cockpit because of an autopilot write-up. Now, if we can only get the captain's attention for a little plan.
Hijacker? Did you say a hijacker, Chuck? You know what? I'm going to go up right up there, and I'm going to take care of this nutcase right now.
Wait a minute, Luann. Listen here. What I suggest we do, Margaret, is we can call the cockpit and ask them if they want something to drink. And while you're on the phone, tell them Chuck wants to see the autopilot. We'll do it if it's disconnected. I think he'll know exactly what I'm referring to.
And then can I go up and whack him in the head?
As soon as the airplane starts to roll and pitch, I'll enter the cockpit door and see if we can help with the autopilot problem. And you come in right behind me with the flashlight now, and take that flashlight. I'll take that flashlight from you and see if I can use it to shine some light on that guy's head.
Okay, here goes. Luann, get your WMD flashlight.
Up in the cockpit, the crew has entered Cuban airspace and contacts Havana Center.
Havana Center, Eastern 58, requesting to land at Jose Marti International Airport. We have a hijacker that has taken over our flight with the threat of an explosive device in the form of a hand grenade. He is occupying our cockpit at the present time. We're at flight level 370 with a flight plan filed for Atlanta, Georgia.
Roger, your Eastern 58, please squawk code 2344 in your transponder.
Havana, do you copy? Over.
Roger. Eastern 58, please squawk code 2344 on your transponder.
Roger, we're coming off the emergency squawk over to 2344, and here comes our ident.
Roger, Eastern 58, we have a radar contact that descends to maintain 13,000. Altimeter is 30.05.
Roger, we are leaving flight level 370.
for 13,000 altimeter 30.05.
Hey, Bud, ask him which runway they're using and if they have a special area on the airport that is used for situations like ours.
All right, we'll do that, sir. Havana Center, which runway do you plan us so that we can plan our landing? And also, do you have a designated area for us to taxi to for our special situation?
Mr. Platt on runway 06, and yes, we have an area on the northern side of the approach end of the runway 06. Ground control will give you back taxi instructions as you are when you are on the ground. We will have our government people to follow up your aircraft when you arrive. I see you're about to level in 13,000. Contact Havana Tower in 119.85.
Roger, Havana. Thank you for your help. We're going over to 119.85.
Soon after Eastern 58 leaves flight level 370, the flight attendant calls the cockpit.
Neil, this is Margaret. Do you guys or your uninvited guests want anything to drink? And by the way, Chuck says to disengage the autopilot to see if you're getting any unusual attitudes, whatever that means.
Yeah, I think I understand. Okay, Margaret, no to your first question, and the second we will initiate when I hang up. Bye-bye. Hey, Captain, Chuck wants you to disengage the autopilot for test purposes.
The captain disengages the autopilot and deliberately inputs hard control on the ailerons, elevators, and rudder. This causes the aircraft to enter into a Dutch roll-type maneuver with the appearance of an aircraft out of control. At the same time, the cockpit door is thrown open by Chuck and Luann, with Chuck falling upon the hijacker. Luann immediately swings her flashlight weapon, aiming for the center of the hijacker's head.
Take that, and that, and that, you no-good hijacking son of a biscuit eater.
I think you can stop now, Luann. He's not moving. And look, he just dropped the grenade. Hey, Chuck, it's behind the jump seat. Be careful when you pick it up. It may still be ready to go off.
I've got it, heck. This is a G.I. Joe plastic toy model of a hand grenade. Here, Neil, I'm turning it over to you.
Chuck, see if you can get something to restrain him if he comes to. Here, take my tie, Bud, off with yours and yours too, Neil. And use belts if that's not enough. Bud, here, you fly the airplane, and I'll tell the passengers what's happened and cause of the violent tossing of the airplane.
Eastern 58, this is Havana approach. Turn left to the heading of 210 and descend to maintain 3,000.
Havana approach is Eastern 58. We'd like a vector out of your control airspace back to Miami. We have subdued the hijacker and would now like to proceed direct to Miami.
Roger, Eastern 58. Turn right to the heading 290 and climb to flight level 230.
Roger, heading 290, maintain flight level 230. But I'm off the air for a few minutes, and I'll see if I can explain to what's to all that's happened so far to our passengers.
Okay.
The captain tells the passengers the reason for the aircraft being flown erratically and about the hijacker that was now subdued, restrained, and for now unconscious in the cockpit. He also explains that they were now proceeding direct to Miami because the aircraft would have to be refueled for the continuing flight to Atlanta. To be continued. The cast for tonight's show were Captain Steve Thompson, First Officer Bud Hescock, Second Officer Neil Holland, Senior Flight Attendant Margaret Bars, and also Luann was played by Margaret Bars. I'm the narrator, Bill Joseph, Maintenance Supervisor Chuck Albright, Havana Center was Hector Santa Maria, and the hijacker was Bud Hescock.
Folks, you can read the article about the real hijacking of an Eastern Boeing 727 August 17, 1979. I found the story on the Internet, and I forgot what newspaper, but I just typed in my browser, Eastern hijacking,
Boeing 727, August 1979, and there's the actual story of the hijack that you just heard. We've changed a little bit of the scenery in the cockpit and in the cabin, of course, but basically the hijacker, his name was Ala Hagen, or Kagan, I should say, Ala Kagan, and he lived up in the Boston area, and he was just released from a mental institution and somehow got down to Guatemala. Don't know the exact, the story didn't really say exactly what he was doing in Guatemala, but on the flight back to Miami from Guatemala, he was on board the aircraft, and apparently it was the smaller Boeing 727-100 series, and there were 84 passengers on the airplane, and the crew actually did subdue the hijacker in the cabin of the airplane and physically took the ties off the passengers, tied the hijacker up, and I think the article said that a couple of passengers sat on him and so that he would not try to get up and make a disturbance. But his tool that he used as far as the weapon was a knife, and he had what looked to be like a transistor radio wrapped in tape, with the appearance that it could have been a bomb. So that was the actual flight, and it did land in Miami, but the airplane did go into Cuban airspace, and so we tried to recreate the actual hijacking as it might have been, with a few changes. I'm sure if Lou Ann was on that flight, she would have definitely used her weapon of mass destruction. Is that what you call it, Lou Ann?
Yes, I do. It's a heavy-duty flashlight. I carry it with me wherever I go.
Oh, so it got about 10 batteries in it?
I believe so, and I carry a backup battery pack, too.
Steve or Bud or anyone, I don't know if you've ever been on a hijacking, Bud or
no.
Steve.
I haven't.
No, I have not.
Closest I came was the Eastern. I was working the ramp in Boston for Allegheny Airlines, and that Eastern DC-9 that was hijacked with the pilots were shot. It went flying by me, and that was the closest I came to anything to such as a hijacking.
Yeah. Well, we had several hijackings, of course, DC-9s, and I recall that I could tell you the whole scenario, but remember, and Steve, you probably remember this too, Tom Mayberry.
Oh, yes.
An Atlanta-based captain being hijacked in the DC-9, and I believe in that instance they didn't have enough fuel to reach Havana, or either they had just enough, barely enough to reach it. And Tom took the hijacker to Havana, just like the hijacker wanted. But I guess they're still doing some hijackings over in the Middle Eastern part of the country or the world. But you don't hear much of that happening anymore. Now it's terrorists, and they, threatening to blow the entire airplane up. So
that was pretty rampant at the time until the governments got involved in. Well, Cuba would send they'd arrest them and they land in Cuba and send them back to the United States or confine them. And that seemed to subside a lot of the.
There's also an article in the found on the internet about Lee Hines, again, another Atlanta captain. And Lee Hines was, forgot what airplane, I think it was a 727, and they were parked at Houston, the old Houston Hobby Airport at the time. And they had a guy that ran down the jetway to get on board the airplane, and he had a gun. I don't know how he got through. Of course, in those days, they didn't have the TSA services that they have today. But he managed to get the gun by the security, ran out the jetway just as the airplane was being closed by the agent, and the hijacker shot the agent, as a matter of fact, killed the agent. And got on board the airplane, and I forgot the exact events following that, and what happened, whether they took off or whether the airplane never took off from Houston. But so we did have our share from Atlanta crews, and I'm sure Miami, New York had a lot of them as well. How about it while you were up in New England up there, Bill? Did y'all have anything that you can remember as far as hijackings?
Not in New England, Neil, but I can confirm that situation you just went through there in Houston. We had a similar situation in Baltimore. You might remember the hijacker went down the jetway and shot the Delta captain right through the window. And the reason for that was they were doing screenings in the gate area prior to that. So that's what moved the screenings up to central parts of the terminal. People were not getting screened until they were already in the gate area.
About what year was that? Do you recall? About
let's see, 73, 74, probably.
Yeah. I remember.
Hey, Neil, this is
Chuck. Yeah, Chuck, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering, maybe one of you guys, I heard a story. Pan Am got hijacked, and they took the plane into the Middle East. And there was a standoff there for a while, and finally the hijackers were taken off the airplane, and of course the I can't remember which country it was, they were going to allow the plane to come back. One of the glitches in the whole thing was is the plane was empty of fuel when he got there, so the whoever was running the airport told the pilot that they had to pay for the gas, the fuel, to get back. And of course they didn't have that kind of money. They were flying, I believe, 707s, and that would, even back in those days, the fuel would have cost a lot of money. And if I recall, on the story is that one of the girls had an American Express card, and they called American Express and they paid for the fuel that way. Has anybody ever heard about that story?
No, but I understand that's how they came up with that slogan, never leave your home without your American Express card.
I'll bet.
But no, I was just making fun of that slogan there. But no, I remember a little bit about it, but I think that I'm sure was very possible that happened.
You remember the one at the TWA flight that they hijacked in the Middle East, and they kept them, they were there for a week or something?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah.
They ended up blowing up the airplane?
I think they killed some passengers and threw them off the airplane.
Right.
Didn't they? During
yeah, they're getting very... It was Abby Nadal that did that, I believe.
My golly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's... yeah, go ahead, Chuck.
You know, fortunately, like you said, the governments have got together because they all at one time have experienced similar acts of terrorism. And we don't see those hijackings anymore. But you do see them blow up the airplanes. There was a couple of them here 2 or 3 years ago that they blew up some on the tarmac. But it's just amazing that people that do these things, how little they care for life and just for a cause. And it just amazes me that we had to go through these terrible years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, they do have some procedures in the event of a hijacking, and we won't get into a discussion about that or give away any secrets.
True.
But there are some signals that ground crews and air traffic controllers in the tower, seeing an airplane doing certain things, it's an indication that they are under a hijack.
You can actually get a lot of information without having to press the mic button, just by things watching what the airplane will do.
Yeah. I'm sure procedures have changed since we've flown airplanes.
Oh, yeah.
About terrorist activities.
I have a question I'd like to ask. Let's say someone does get onto an airplane, and let's say that they actually have a gun. I've always wondered about that. And the gun is fired. What happens to the pressure in the cabin or in the
Steve, plane? That's yours.
Oh boy, that is a toughie. I haven't experienced anything like that, so I really don't know. But my guess is that you first of all, you're going to lose your lose the pressure. Now, in my view, it would not be an explosive decompression.
Okay.
But then on the other hand, it very might very well cause a pretty big hole in the side of the fuselage, wherever the bullet exit.
Yeah. Chuck?
I'd like to say something about that. You're right. It's where the bullet goes out. If it goes out through the metal part of the fuselage, most likely you're going to see a hole about the size of the bullet. But if it takes out a window, because, you know, the windows in airplanes are not made out of glass. They're made out of a special plexiglass. And there's three different windows, panes in each window. And that's for the pressurization. Now, if you blow that whole window out, now you've got a hole about the size of a basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And the decompression does start. But I think most pilots that get that decompression know that they can get the plane down to about 10 or 11,000 feet. It's according to how high you are. To me, I've been told that it would take an awful lot. It's like an explosion, like blowing out a door,
right,
to really blow the plane apart or blow people out. Remember when the Honolulu plane peeled its skin back because of loose rivets? That is something horrendous, and that was automatic. They lost people on that one.
Yeah.
But just shooting the side where the metal is, I don't think you're going to decompress too fast. You are going to decompress, but not really fast.
Yeah, you know, I had the experience in the Boeing 727, that gap about 2 inches at the door, and I keep the pressure for a while, putting pillows over there. So the gap doesn't allow me really decompress the plane, you know. And the size of the bullet can be really smaller than that. You can manage to control the pressure inside.
Okay.
Well, you've got that outflow valve that is constantly metering the air in going through the cabin, and that would probably compensate for the hole made by the bullet.
I've had one rapid descent, emergency descent, and it was in a 727, and we were at 30-some thousand feet. Just left Tallahassee, passed over Tallahassee en route to Atlanta, and the first thing I remember hearing was the engineer saying, "Captain, I can't control the cabin altitude." And, you know, that's what it sounded like, a simulator at that point. Yeah, I said, "Oh boy, this sounds like they're giving me a trick in the simulator." And he says, "I'm serious. The cabin is climbing and I can't control it." And what had happened, they found out when we got to Atlanta. Of course, I made the emergency descent, you know, the speed brake, and the airplane was shaking like, you know, I was pushing it down. And we came right on down too. And when we got to Atlanta, the mechanics told me, I think the next day or whenever I was back out at the airport, they said that the outflow valve had been stuck by some material that had escaped the cargo, one of the cargo compartments that was situated, I guess it would be the aft cargo compartment, situated back there by those outflow valves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the 727 had two outflow valves, I believe, didn't it? Yeah, best I can recall.
Yeah. 10-11s have four.
Yeah.
Sometimes the nicotine is stuck.
Yeah, it sticks, yeah. Yeah, but in this case, they actually have something.
Smoking on airplanes, the nicotine and tar would go into the outflow valves and jam them up after a while, and they would just stick closed or they'd stick open. And there's a sensor that operates that valve. And, of course, the input signal from the sensor would go to the valve, and the valve wouldn't go wherever you wanted it to go. So that was one of the primary reasons of smoking. They stopped the smoking.
Yeah.
The valves are
terrible. I think there were two ways of controlling it pneumatically.
Pneumatically, yeah.
And then the manual control of it. And that was the last resort when you couldn't control it manually. You know, you had to do a descent. Because those masks.
Yeah, they have a little wrench mechanism on them. It's kind of like an Allen wrench.
Yeah.
And you stick it in this little octagon, and you can move it back and forth.
How big are those valves? They're pretty good size.
They're not really big in the smaller airplanes. I would say they were probably about the size of about the size of a 8 by 11.5 piece of paper, about that, that size. But the 10-11 ones, they're almost like 2 feet long. Or a little bit longer, maybe, and I'd say about 8 or 10 inches wide. They're pretty big.
They're not round either, are they? 10, 11.
No. All you see on the outside is a round hole.
Yeah.
But the valve itself is put inside an area that operates that these like a louver mechanism. You know, it's kind of like a Venetian blind thing. Yeah. And, but these are just plates. You know, the plates open up and the plates close. But yeah, they take them out. Maintenance says you have to take them out after so many flight hours. And they have to be overhauled and cleaned and everything else. Because, like you said, there's debris flying around in some of the areas that you don't see in the airplane. You know, a 727 has three baggage compartments. And the aft baggage compartment is not heated or pressurized. That's where they usually put the mail and stuff, as long as you don't put a dog there. So there's things floating around in there, even though it's not pressurized in there. If something gets loose, it can scoot through the back of the walls there and then get to the valves.
Yeah.
But it's very unlikely. You know, they're very careful about how they package things and how things are packed in airplanes. It's you know, the 1011s had the auto bag systems. They look like big trailers, and you just come up with a maintenance truck, and it held two of them, and you pushed a little button and they rolled in, like kind of like Disney World, and then it would actually go to the left to the right, and they'd stack in. I think you could put like 10 of them in the second compartment of a 1011, and that's where your bags are. They never actually touch the airplane. There's little rollers inside that have motors to them that make these cargo containers move in and out. They were really a maintenance headache, but they work really great when they work.
Yeah.
So most of the stuff was contained. Unless something really blew apart in there, it was almost impossible to get to these electronics and stuff.
Another thing that I always chuckled when I'd hear on the news where somebody had threatened to open the door and jump out of the airplane in flight. And it's virtually impossible to do.
Well, I had several experiences flying from L.A. to Mexico City. The people in the back tried to open the back door, and all of a sudden the light come up, and immediately when they unlocked the back door.
Yeah, but the door doesn't go anywhere. It's a plugged door.
Yeah.
Yes. And that was the. Yeah. I'm going to jump. Yeah, go ahead.
The other doors that are not plugged doors, they actually have two locking. It actually moves up. So if you just pull the handle, those little feet, we call them, are going to stop the door from going anywhere. You're going to hear a real loud whistle. Because every once in a while, the door would get out of adjustment, and the flight crews would tell us that there was whistling at the door. Or they would get water in the door when they fly through stuff, and the girls would just take the blankets and put next to the doors, and of course they would suck into these little places that where the door was on. But for most part, the doors, it would be almost impossible to open the doors up in flight.
Yeah.
But now if you get down below, 10,000 feet, you can open a 727 door in the back.
Yeah.
They got a little thing. That stops it, though.
You think you could really do that? Because I know on the ground it's pressurized to 0.125 PSI, and you can't get it open then. Are you sure?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but it is.
Yeah.
But once you drop below around 10,000 feet, then you can open the doors. You remember the D.D. Cooper thing?
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
But there's something that stops that. That's been put into effect. You can't open them anymore.
That little vein in the back.
Hijack vein in the back, the B.D. Cooper
stuff. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting discussion about hijacking, and we had a little boat trip earlier in the show, and it sounded like they had a lot of fun, the crew.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Bud got his reward by having a hijacking happen on his...
Just what I needed, no sleep, hangover, bringing a headache, and then somebody hijacks the airplane.
That's what you get for fooling around with a woman.
Yeah. I didn't do anything
Victoria,
wrong.
Yeah.
Victoria's secret.
That's Victoria's secret.
Will Ann, I think you're not getting enough of socialization out there.
Oh, she is, but she keeps hitting them with a flashlight.
Yeah, I don't think I got that courting thing down very well.
No. You going to kiss me tonight or knock me out?
Well, just mail you suggestions to my email address.
I'm not certain who emailed me today. It was Bill Hirsch, I believe. Bill Joseph, you have some great emails. I already am entertained most of the day by Bill Joseph's.
Oh, his email. Bill, those emails are
great.
Where you make it sound like I have nothing else to do in life.
Right.
Well, don't start doing anything now. We've missed the emails.
It's called retirement.
I went through a bunch today, and I've still got more to go.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Bill Hirsch sent you guys that video of Sully and Jeff Skiles flying the DC-7 and getting their type rating in the airplane.
Really
a great video. I'll email it to you, and I'll probably try to put it on the website. But it's a great video of the DC-7 and what these guys went through. And they actually got their type ratings on the airplane. Sully did, and Jeff Skiles, the co-pilot, and they did a good job. It was Jeff's birthday when they took the airplane up to Charlotte on that flight with passengers that were paying, I think, $1,000 a seat, I believe, or $2,000. I forgot what the price was. But they had a full airplane going up to Charlotte, and it was Jeff's birthday, so they let him make the landing in Charlotte, and he did a great landing. So you'll get a kick out of that video. I'll email it to all of you so you can see it.
I got a question about that, Neil.
Yeah.
When did they lose that engine, or how did they come about that engine? Actually, they had to. They're going to have to completely replace that engine.
Yeah, I thought that it was on the trip back to Opa-locka that they lost it, but I think they went up there without any incident, I believe. That's the way I understood it.
I know Sully was on board when it happened.
Yeah. But I'm not certain. I can't answer your question there, Steve, but I believe they do have to change the engine, and, boy, that's an expensive deal.
Well, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to take the story that I heard was going to be 6 months because I wanted to go down there and look at the airplane.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you've got plenty of time. It's going to take – it'll be here for at least 6 months, so.
Wow. But where is it, in Opa-locka?
It's in Charlotte.
Okay, it's still in Charlotte. Okay, well,
yes.
They must have turned back. They were able to land and make a three-engine engine-out landing. So that was very interesting. Yeah, and the chief pilot was the narrator of this video, and it does a great job about reciprocating engines. And, you know, to see at night the fire coming out of the cowling of these radial engines is enough to frighten passengers in seeing that. But in those days, they were used to that because of the what we call the power recovery turbines, the PRTs, burning that exhaust gas to power a turbine to give it extra horsepower. And I think the chief pilot was saying that it gave each engine an extra 150 horsepower of power for that engine. So it was very interesting. It was a good video. So you guys will enjoy that, and I'll put it on the internet website.
As I told you, and I think in an email, I was going through some files, and I found every single one of my line checks and flight checks, and the only check ride that I ever flunked in my life was a DC-7 engineer check ride. And Tom Lott was actually getting his designee rating then. And the procedure on a DC-7 was, if you had an engine fire simulated, you know, it was throttle, mixture, no wonder I screwed it up. But it was throttle, mixture, something else,
props. Throttle mixture props.
Props was not in the emergency procedures.
Okay.
Throttle mixture.
Carb heat.
It was probably. No.
Yeah.
No. But at any rate,
well,
the first thing that I Yeah, the first thing that I reached for was the fire handle before I reached for anything else. And then they said, okay, all right, let's go back. That's all.
You didn't pull it. Did you touch
no,
it?
No, I didn't. No.
Well, I thought I was going to fill my check ride as an engineer on the Electra. And I'll never forget when I did a good oil, the only oil I had on the Electra as an engineer. And that was kind of, as you recall, kind of a nightmare airplane to get your rating on. And because that gear reduction box up in the front between the engine and the prop was a nightmare in trying to explain that. So I was really prepared for that gear reduction drive up there. And the rest of it came pretty easy. But when I walked in, he said, here's a piece of paper, here's a pencil, draw me the fuel system.
Oh, boy.
Oh, nightmare.
He wanted me to draw it. I said, well, you mean I got to put on all the bends and turns? He said, no, just draw a straight line and just tell me where that fuel goes to get to the engine. From the tank to the engine. And he says, put in all the valves.
Oh, my gosh.
And I did. He went out and got a cup of coffee, and he came back, and I had this thing drawn. And of course, he looked at it and didn't say anything. He says, okay, let's go fly.
Really?
Yeah. And then on the flight, he was about to fail me when we walked in. He said, well, everything was good. You did a good ride, except you didn't do one thing. He said, when the co-pilot put the gear down, the two of them said, down in three green. You didn't say it. And I thought, oh, my God, don't tell me he's going to bust me for that. He didn't. He didn't bust me, but that was one thing that he remarked. He said, because it takes three responses from all three guys. They verified.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Down in three green lights, all three of you.
Wow.
So, I believe that would be a good subject for a radio show is to talk about all of our rating rides.
Oh, God.
Oh wow.
But I really think next week we are going to talk a little bit about the airlines that were and are no longer.
Oh, that'd be historic.
And we can talk a little bit about that. Steve sent me a whole list of all the airlines that were big back in the days that we flew airplanes. And so I think it would be interesting to talk about all those airlines, the American airlines that went out of business.
Yeah.
So we'll have a show on that.
Has anybody remember the congressional hearing where Frank Borman went and they were talking about how the airlines were not doing the job that they were supposed to do, and that's why the government was allowing a lot of these mergers and stuff. And I don't know exactly how the conversation went, but I remember Frank Borman getting up in front of this congressional committee and saying, if you keep this going in the future, there's only going to be five major airlines in the United States.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Now we're down almost down to three now, aren't we?
That was the plan.
Yeah.
Well, we've got an American Airlines captain that was division chief pilot for Caribbean and the Latin American division here in Jacksonville. That's a good friend of mine. And we had a little meeting yesterday, and he was talking about the fact that very soon there will be no more American Airlines. Right now, the federal government is starting to award some of these other airlines their routes. Yeah, their routes. So we don't need that.
There won't be anything as American on it pretty soon.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But
they had the
cutover of Continental and United Saturday. There'll be no more designated Continental flights after Saturday, last Saturday.
Really?
Yeah, I think the intention is...
They merged the two computer systems, which was a difficult thing to do.
Didn't Continental get our System 1?
Continental bought System 1 for almost nothing.
Yeah. They stole it, yes.
Oh, yeah, Lorenzo.
Exactly.
Really, yeah.
Hector?
I think the intention is made a regional airlines. because it included Canada, United States, and Mexico. And
regional airlines. Right?
I think that's the idea.
Yeah. It might be that way.
And look at the difference in the experience for the air traveler today versus what it was when the airlines were regulated. You look at the pictures that I have, and the passengers, they were well dressed, and no flip flops and T-shirts, and as it is today. And of course, we've got all this security that we're so comfortable with, especially if you're carrying empty baby bottles, and it's infuriating to me.
Oh, Steve?
Yes.
It all started with People's Express. We became a Greyhound bus in the sky when People's Express came into being.
Donald Burr.
That's true.
Yeah, Donald Burr.
That is the one place you can lay it if you look through the whole industry at that time.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember when I got hired, and I had 10,000 hours, and 5,000 of it were in jet airplanes, and I was lucky to get the job. And now today, the qualifications of pilots have been stretched to the they don't really have to have hardly any time at all to fly in the right seat. And as the companies expand, they are upgrading to the left seat a lot sooner than they should.
Yeah,
that's right.
Didn't the FAA up some of the hours here because of that crash up in, what was it, New York?
In Buffalo?
Yeah.
That girl who was flying the co-pilot's job there for Colgan Airways had never flown in icing conditions before.
Yeah.
The pilot was from Lutz, just outside of Tampa.
And apparently they didn't know how to recover from a stall or something.
Exactly.
That was it.
Yeah, that doesn't set well for the industry. I guarantee you that.
Well, you know what?
Go ahead.
When I was talking about Borman, one of the things he says, when you deregulate the airlines, it's going to end up like the trucking industry and all the other things that you deregulated. And now you see it with this, when you talked about Express being the first airline that you could wear flip-flops on, you know. And that's basically what happened.
Yeah. Well, folks, that's about our time. We're getting close to our time for our show tonight, and we'd like to thank all of our listeners and club members. We'll be back with you again the same time next week, same station, ELRadioShow.com, and we hope to, again, bring you a very interesting program. Once again, Fly Eastern Radio, as we bring you interviews with former Eastern employees. It's about time we give Mr. Hall a call again and chat with him a little while. So we'll put on our email when we send it out what the program is going to be all about. But this will be our 59th departure from the gate next week. And so we want to make sure that you're all on board for another interesting show. And so right now we will go out with our song.
Good night, until we meet again. Adios, au revoir.
From all of the gang here at the studio and all of our remote locations, we'll all say together,
good night. Good night,
Eastern family.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
And Luann, wherever you are.
Okay, good night.
Friends, there you have our show, hit songs and fashions through the years.
Yeah.